Megan, what's going on?
I'm just working on some files and show
no,
prep.
No. I mean, like, with me. What happened to me?
Oh, no one told you yet?
No.
You died.
I died? Like, I'm dead. I'm dead right now.
You certainly are.
But how? I mean, the last thing I remember was just riding a bicycle in Henrietta and... Oh, boy. Yeah, that actually makes sense.
Yeah, sorry, man. You're dead.
So, I mean, I assume you're dead, too?
No, not at all. I wouldn't have time to be dead.
Well, then what are you doing here?
Producing for the afterlife. I'm stretched a little thin, but that's nothing new.
All right. I'm confused. So this is heaven, I guess.
Heaven? Not even close. Does this look like heaven?
I guess it looks like the second floor at WXXI, which I actually think is pretty cool. But...
It is not heaven.
All right. So where are we?
Well, first the universe has to figure out if you're qualified to get into the good place, or heaven, or paradise, or a Guster concert, whatever you want to call it. But if you're not, you'll have to go to the bad place, or hell, or pretty much for you, endless Duran Duran concerts. What?
Well, I mean, like, how do I know whether I'm qualified? What's going to happen?
Well, the universe is tallying up your points.
My points?
Everything you did in life, it earned or cost you points. Hey, remember that time you gave $5 to a person who was homeless, maybe back in 1997?
I mean, I guess. That must have gotten me points, right?
Well, no, you did it to impress a woman, so it actually cost you points. That's just an example of how all this works. What?
Boy, I'm stunned. I mean, I'm actually kind of impressed, but I'm not sure this exactly seems fair.
Listen, none of this is really fair. Baseball playoffs, Iowa caucuses, pretty much everything is a sliding scale affair. So here's hoping you did just enough to get to heaven.
And what if I didn't? How am I going to know?
Well, I think we're about to find out.
Her name is Rio and she dances on the sand.
Oh, God. I hope you enjoyed that little introduction produced by, of course, Megan Mack, who would produce for the afterlife if there were an afterlife. She would probably be shouldering the load for that, as she does for Connections and for WXXI. And if there's anybody who's sort of an automatic to get in, it would be her. But otherwise, what about the rest of us? Well, The Good Place just concluded a 4-year run on NBC. The show focused on a fictional afterlife in which Universe employees used a point system to determine who got into heaven or the good place, or hell, known as the bad place. One person improbably made it to the medium place. But in the show's final two episodes, writers were focused on a couple of ideas as they wrapped up the show. Of course, there was this idea that the system wasn't fair. So the main characters created their own system, kind of reworked it, and had to convince the universe architects and the judge that they had to do it a different way. But then when they finally got to see what the real good place was all about, it turns out it was sort of boring. That after a while, people just sort of vegged out and their brains kind of stopped being stimulated. And that wasn't good either. So it had a lot of us thinking about ethics, why we do what we do on Earth, and what an afterlife would be like if there is one. Would it be filled with torture or paradise or something in between? What does it really mean to be in heaven or paradise? And what would it mean if there were a universe that were torturing people? Well, we sought out a couple of guests who I think we're going to really enjoy talking to today. One of them does believe in sort of that idea of a paradigm of heaven and hell, and eternal torture for those who aren't there, and paradise for those who are in heaven. And one guest has a background in ethics and philosophy and has a sort of some differing views. So hello to both of them. Deanna Spiata is a nonprofit sector employee, a songwriter, and a worship leader at a local church. And by the way, I think a Good Place fan.
Yes, definitely.
It was great to have you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And also hello to Jake Vojtovich, who is an ethics and philosophy writer and a professor of ethics at Brockport. He has seen most of The Good Place, including the final several episodes. Great to have you. Thank you for being here as well.
Thanks for having me.
Jake was pointing out, as the show began, if you're a Good Place fan, and by the way, you don't have to be a Good Place fan to kind of dig this conversation this hour, I hope anyway, but if you watch the finale, There was a scene early on where some of the philosophy writers that the show has referred to over the course of four seasons were actually in one of the scenes. That's right?
Yeah, they had a couple of professional ethicists.
Was it kind of geeky fun for you to see that?
I recognize one of them, but when you do philosophy, you read the books and you don't know what they look like all the time. So.
Those people actually look like people. It's hard to get your head around. Well, look, I'm really glad to have both of you here. And I have to confess, I loved the show. We have some clips coming up here that I think will illustrate why it had us thinking. But let's kind of start with a broad view. First of all, Deanna, you love the show.
Yes.
Why did you love The Good Place?
I first heard about it from a friend and I caught up on Netflix. But I love the fantasy part of it. I actually feel like it's kind of like a modern day Wizard of Oz, and I love the Wizard of Oz. Obviously different themes, but I think just the fun of it and the things that it provokes, like the thoughts that it provoked for me, is why I kept watching.
Despite the fact that the show, I think, challenged the notion of any sort of a justification for torture and pain and internal suffering. And that is something that you believe in as a possibility for a destination for us, yes?
Yes.
All right, well.
It's a hard thing to believe in, but yes.
No, but if you believe it, you believe it, and we're going to explore more of that. So, Jake, you know, for you, having seen most of the show, why did you dig it if you dug it?
I thought it was really funny. Regardless of all the philosophy stuff, it was just really funny. But also there's something nice about when you do philosophy, you're doing this obscure thing that most people don't do. And when you see the books that you read in the background, you know, it's cool.
I think as far as I understand it, the devotion to philosophy throughout the four seasons was authentic in that it might not have been the deepest show on philosophy, but for a network sitcom, it went deeper than most. And would you call it an authentic devotion, at least exploring some of those issues?
Yeah. It sometimes the philosophy is central to it. You know, they're exploring the meaning of life and immortality and what we're doing there. And by doing it in a funny network show, it sort of puts this philosophy idea out into the wild, and we can talk about it on the radio, or you know, you can talk about it in the pub or whatever.
Yeah, it makes it a little bit more accessible, perhaps.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm not sure that this matters much to you, but you want to share your personal beliefs? Do you believe that a universe is going to send us to potential pain and suffering or paradise?
That's way beyond my pay grade. I really don't know.
You're sort of agnostic on the process.
Yeah. I'm not smart enough to.
The answer is maybe. Don't really have the evidence yet.
Maybe.
Okay.
I shrug. I don't know.
Okay.
It would be nice. It would be nice.
Well, I'm sorry. What would be nice? The eternal suffering part?
No. But the eternal
Schadenfreude
happiness,
of that? No. The eternal happiness.
That, yeah. Yeah. That would be nice.
You want to add something there, Deanna?
I was just going to say it would be nice if you go to heaven. I guess it would be, you know, it can be scary. Depending on if we don't know that outcome.
And that's a lot of pressure. If we were to find out that this actually exists, that's a lot of pressure. So let's talk about how we determine fairness. And the show brought some ideas forward very early on. I loved the opening episodes. And I didn't know if the show could conclude four seasons as high as it started, because any show goes through ebbs and flows. But I thought they did a pretty good job. But in the beginning, the characters wake up, they're in the good place, they've died, and they're told that, well, you know, you cleared the bar, you lived a good life, you're essentially in heaven, yay for you. And Kristen Bell's character realizes, oh my gosh, they've got the wrong person. My name is Eleanor Shellstrop, but there's another Eleanor Shellstrop who was the good Eleanor Shellstrop. She got sent to the bad place, she got sent to hell. The universe screwed up and sent me, and I was not a great person on earth, here, and they think I did all of that good stuff, and I've got to do something here, or maybe I don't. Maybe I've got to figure out a way to stay here. It's a great little premise, but it turns out to be a lot deeper than that. And she's told, well, here's how you get the points you get. Everything you did, every little thing in life. And eventually, they feel like that's not fair. Deanna, do you feel like, in your notion of sort of how we are judged as human beings, does, in some sense, I doubt you think there's a point scale, but does every action sort of add up and detract? I mean, what do you think, whether it's God, a creator, is looking at there?
So I personally believe, I'm a Christian, so I believe that Jesus Christ is Lord and Lord of the universe. And I don't believe that there's a point system, mm-hmm. because I believe that's why he came to die for us. He was sacrificed so that we could be wiped clean and our debts could be paid for, so to speak. So I don't believe there's a point system, but I do believe that the Bible tells us, God tells us that we get to heaven through faith in Christ.
So largely, to the extent that there is sort of that what's on both sides of the ledger, it's do you accept Jesus as a Savior?
Right.
And that can absolve anything else on the other side of the ledger?
Correct. Forgiveness.
Do you struggle with, and again, I'm sure you've thought about this, but do you struggle with the idea that someone can be just about the most virtuous person you can ever think of in the way they treat people, in the way they interact with society, in the way that they give of their time and whatever resources they have, but if they're not accepting of the same God you are, that they may go to hell, whereas someone could be really, really violent and really sort of awful, but have this conversion and end up in paradise? Do you struggle with that at all?
Yes, definitely. It's something that I'm constantly trying to learn about and praying about, and it can be a really hard thing to struggle with. And I definitely approach this topic from a perspective that I do not know all the answers, and I approach it with love and respect.
Yeah, I mean, like in my earlier, during my Christian days, I struggled with doubt, and I had two different pastors. One told me that, you know, accept doubt and bring it into your heart. Doubt's a absolutely natural and a good thing. And another pastor basically told me that doubt was weakness. So, you know, tough messages there.
Yes, I definitely feel strongly that, at least for me, that I need to ask questions, that God is okay with me asking questions.
Yeah.
He can handle those questions and that he will guide me through them. So I think it's really important to ask those questions because it will strengthen my faith.
Okay. Jake, do you think, I guess I'm going to ask you, would you be surprised to find out that the universe is keeping score on every action and that's going to be the metric for whether you're going to heaven or hell?
I think that would be a bad idea. So there's one character in the show, I can't remember his name, but he decides that he has to try and live the best possible life.
Doug something or other.
Forsythe?
Doug Forsythe.
That's him.
Yes.
Yeah, he decides that you have to get as many points as possible because he had this acid-induced vision.
And it turned out to be the right one.
And it was right, yeah.
Yes. Yes.
But he lives his life slicing radishes and just eating radishes and lentils because
it's like the least environmental impact.
Yeah, he cries when he kills a snail. And there's probably something to be said for that level of mindfulness and appreciation of other people. But that's not a good life. That's probably a bad life in many ways, and that sort of comes out, I think, in some of the episodes I haven't seen.
Yes. Yeah. Let's listen, if we could, to a clip in which Michael is played by Ted Danson and is talking to the judge of the universe, who is played by Maya Rudolph. By the way, exquisite casting in this show. Mm-hmm. Now, Michael, played by Ted Danson, is not a human. He is an architect, but he spent much of his existence as a demon who took joy in torturing people who went to the bad place, but then sort of got tired of that and tried to devise other experiments. And he grew to have affection for human beings and to see human beings as kind of getting a raw deal in the afterlife. So he ends up working with the main characters, trying to convince the judge of the universe, you got to let us come up with a different system. This system does not work. The point system is screwed up. And Maya Rudolph, the judge, is sort of not having it. So here is Ted Danson as Michael trying to convince her to change the point system.
All right, why don't we all sit down so I can fill the judge in on what we've learned. Your Honor, I once stood in front of you and said I thought there was something wrong with the point system. I finally know what it is. Life now is so complicated. It's impossible for anyone to be good enough for the good place. I know you don't like to learn too much about life on Earth to remain impartial, but these days just buying a tomato at a grocery store means that you are unwittingly supporting toxic pesticides, exploiting labor, contributing to global warming. Humans think that they're making one choice, but they're actually making dozens of choices they don't even know they're making.
Your big revelation is life is complicated? That's not a revelation. That's a divorced woman's throw pillow. I mean, this guy chose this tomato. Those are the consequences. You don't want the consequences? Do the research. Buy another tomato.
She's not swayed. I love that scene because I think there's a lot there. First of all, what do you make of that, Deanna?
Well, I was just laughing at the life is complicated comment. It's something I'm learning as I get older. But It sounded like at the end she was kind of saying, like, we'll do the work, get the answer. And that troubles me because I don't have the answer and I don't know if I ever will. But I can only go on faith and trust.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Jay, what do you think of that?
So I think this brings out a really good objection to one of the main ethical theories, which is utilitarianism. And the idea is that you're responsible for all the happiness you bring into the world. And the main objection is, you can't tell what happiness you're going to bring into the world because everything's so complicated. And the show makes that point really well by saying, look, you buy a tomato and all these things happen. And it's really unfair to judge people based on that.
The judge's idea, though, that it's actually up to each person to do more than just think, well, I'm buying a tomato. To do the work of understanding the chain of events that led to the creation of that piece of food and what it means is actually part of sort of an evolving set of education. People like Zoe Weil, among others, have tried to create new educational models in which children are taught, is probably as early as elementary school, that if you buy a piece of clothing, you can look at a label and start to learn more about that. And you can ask about labor conditions. And you can try to understand. That doesn't mean that there is a simple, clean, ethical option every time. But it does say, if you don't even try to understand the chain of events, then you're kind of doing it wrong. What do you think, Deanna?
I definitely value being an informed consumer. And I love to research everything and learn things. So I feel like that's part of how I naturally approach my decisions. But that feels like a lot of pressure, too.
I think it's a ton of pressure. And the first time I talked to, for example, Zoe Weil, who kind of works with these new educational models, I thought, oh my gosh, like, what am I wearing? Is she going to look at the labels on my clothing? Am I going to lose points in the universe? And I was curious to ask her because I said, well, you know, you've got a what looks like kind of a designer sweater on, and do you know where it was made? And she said, she actually gave me a really interesting answer. She said, I believe that I get everything just about secondhand. It has already been purchased. It is out in the world. I am not creating a chain where I am the consumer for the first time of a product created by someone under what I would consider unfair labor standards or wages, et cetera. Once it's out in the world, I can purchase it, I can bring it into my existence, but I'm not the one who instigates that chain. And I thought, that's a different way of thinking about things. It challenged me, even though, again, I don't think there's a clean, easy answer, but I do think on a day-to-day basis, I don't think enough about it personally. How do you evaluate whether, enough's a hard word, isn't it? Like, what's doing enough? What's thinking enough about the food we eat and the clothes we buy? How do you think about that in your own life?
Well, I guess that's where I'm getting stuck because I don't know. Honestly, I think that it comes down to, like, at what point am I, torturing myself, my mental health, of overthinking those decisions. I've heard people say, and I kind of agree, that we can all fight for something, but it's hard to keep up with every single cause or social justice. So a lot of people just focus on one thing and really go hard and advocate for it. And I think that's manageable, but I'm not sure where that falls with ethics.
Yeah, for me, it's like you could paralyze yourself. You could think,
right.
You could let's say it happens to be a day where you wrote a check to a charity or you gave money. Whatever the amount is, you go, oh, well, I'm going out to dinner with friends this weekend. I don't have to. I can make a box of pasta at home, and whatever I'm going to spend at the restaurant, I could kick to a different organization, or I could give to someone else who needs it more than me. And then the next time you do that, I'm going to go see the RPO. I'm going to go to a game. I'm going to go to a movie with a friend. I shouldn't do that. You can sort of paralyze yourself. And I think that part of the problem is that paralysis is no good. But then simply saying, well, I don't want to be paralyzed is sort of no good either, because you get on sort of the apathetic or lethargic sort of end of the scale. So maybe it's different for every person to figure out where the diminishing returns are. What do you?
I think so. I think that because I thought about that specifically with my budget, mm-hmm. just budgeting out my money for the month.
Sure.
And I just think that to a certain extent, you have to fill your own cup so that it can overflow and you can help others. But everyone has a different answer on like how much you do that and how much you focus on yourself for self-care and how much you give outwardly to others.
All right, Jake, let's talk a little bit from your perspective here. If we can paralyze ourselves thinking about all the things we could be doing but aren't, how do we kind of create a system for ourselves that feels, for lack of a better word, enough or right?
Right. So Chidi, the philosophy professor on the show, is constantly, especially in the early seasons, he doesn't know what to do.
Talk about paralyzed.
Yeah.
Indecisive.
He can't choose between a bagel and a muffin. He's constantly, and my mom always says I'm the same, which is a bit unfair. But
we're going to send her this podcast. Is she still with us?
Yeah, yeah. She's in a different country.
Or the bad place? Yeah, okay. Could have been the medium place?
Yeah, England, the medium place. So she thinks I'm too picky with tea, which is fair. But if you do this, you just sort of, if you have to weigh every possible option, you can't choose. And there's so many different things. And there's always going to be something unforeseen because we're limited humans who can't know the future. So, you know, you buy this tomato instead of this bit of basil or whatever, or, you know, and you end up dropping it on the floor and someone slips and dies. I mean, it seems really unfair to judge you for that. That doesn't seem to be, and it doesn't seem to be something you should weigh up in your deliberations when you're thinking about what to do. You should, you know, some things are good, some things are bad. We should find out more about some things, and other things aren't that important. So, you know, knowing about the supply chain of the tomato is probably good. Thinking about all the possible consequences is going to leave you unable to choose anything, I think.
But again, I think that's the extreme conclusion. Isn't it still valuable, take clothing, to at least try to investigate?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, you should have some idea of these things, and you should understand that buying this T-shirt rather than this T-shirt is going to contribute to sweatshops or whatever. So yeah, you should, some research is good. But,
so why is there so much inertia? Because we have much more knowledge and more what seems to be public discourse about the options. But most of us, even the people, you know, like, it's not like I'm some sort of hero who, you know, is creating new models of understanding the clothing industry. I'm, you know, I feel like, boy, I need to get a shirt. And I go to the store to buy a shirt. And I don't do enough. Like, I actually don't feel like it's enough. Why is inertia so hard to overcome?
Some of us, I mean, life is hard and there's lots of information, and sometimes you don't want to think about the moral costs of things. That could be really damaging. You know, you could end up just thinking about how bad the world is all the time. Another thing is, so one of the writers behind the show, Todd May, he wrote a book called The Decent Life, and he thinks that we should think not about the best possible life and how to do the best moral things, but how we can live decently and treat other people with respect. And part of that might involve thinking about the modes of production for this shirt. But you don't have to think about everything. And some, you know, when people are further away, he thinks you don't impact their life so much. Whereas when people are closer to you, you have to think more about how you treat them. And it's just about finding the way of living a decent life rather than a morally perfect life. And I think there's something to be said for that. It lets you live your life in some way.
And that sort of the extension of what would be maybe a sort of a better societal option, it strikes me as the easier we make the choices that would at least be more in the whole better, you know, systems that are fairer or more egalitarian or lead to less suffering. The way we can make choices less complicated, or if you're going to buy a shirt, how many steps do you need to study to know? The more we can simplify, would seem to me to be a better way to do things.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, the more that, you know, the clothing producers and things do, and they can make more impact than most of us can. And if they offer sort of decent options, better options, that will make our lives easier. It'll make other people's lives better, rather than individuals having to do lots of consumer research to buy a black T-shirt or something.
Sure. By the way, Duran Duran is from England, right?
Yes.
I mean, do you find them as dreadful as I did?
I quite like them. Yeah, I think Hungry Like the Wolf is pretty good.
Producer Megan Mack is cheering back there. We actually put that into the intro just to torture Megan, because we all know that Megan's not going to be eternally tortured whenever her life is over. So you might as well torture her on Earth for making fun of Duran Duran, whom she loves, which no one is perfect. So if you like Duran Duran, the good news is if there is a God, God's probably lenient about Duran Duran. I don't think God's going to torture you for Duran Duran. Do you?
No.
You're a musician.
No.
You're a songwriter.
Correct.
I mean, they're objectively not any good, are they?
I really have only heard Hungry Like a Wolf, so.
You've heard more than you think.
Probably.
You probably have. It's one of those things.
I think I'm in the medium place on that one.
We're going to get to heaven coming up here, but let me just ask you a couple quick questions about hell. I want to ask you a serious question. Why do you think God would sort of be down with people? Let's back this up. What is hell like in your mind? What is that? I mean, it's probably hard to conceive of, but what do you think that's like?
The only thing I can go off of is the Bible. I trust the Bible as the infallible word of God, so I trust that it comes from God. And it's described, Jesus talks about hell and says he describes it as being a place with fire. There's one verse that talks about a lake of fire and where there'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And that's as much as I've learned so far. So I think there are some other gray areas and details to be known that I do not know, or we as humans will not know. But those are the basic scary images.
I mean, it sounds awful.
About.
And in the good place on the show, the bad place, which is its own version of hell on the show, is every terrible thing. It's bears with chainsaws attacking you. It's swarms of bees into your eyeballs. It's the eternal flattening of genitals. I mean, it's lots of terrible things, and fire, along with every annoying thing in your life, you know, compiled up. As humorous as that was, does any of that ring true to what you think might be possible?
I think so. It's really creative. But I also found it interesting about the creative torture that The Good Place, the TV show, brought up.
Yeah.
Like things that I had never considered that, I don't know, maybe that could be part of hell. Like the fact that they basically got the four humans to torture themselves. Like Eleanor, she... to a certain extent was troubled over, she thought that she was in the good place and wasn't supposed to be there. And that was hard for her, and like torturing herself basically. And I think that is very interesting.
Psychological torture.
Yes. Yeah. 'Cause I think I've always thought of it more like a circumstantial torture, or like your surroundings or what's happening to you.
Physical pain.
Then I also just want to at least mention the funny things that I thought that like Michael mentioned once when he was talking to Eleanor. I think he was going off a checklist of like things that get you in the bad place, and it was like microwaving fish in the microwave at the workplace, and clapping when your flight lands, and like I really don't think those things are going to make you go to hell, but I thought it was interesting for a TV show.
Oh my god!
In
the last episode, my favorite character of the whole show was Brent, the white guy CEO who thought he was the greatest thing. And in the final episode, he's still trying to clear the test of the new point system. And he's saying to the interviewer, "You mean I can never tell a woman to smile, like even if it would legitimately make her look better?" It was such a great line.
He said, "I'm helping her." I appreciate it.
I loved that so much. Brent, yes. Norwalk is the name of the character on the show. Just chef's kiss to that character being over the top. But honestly, though, for you, Deanna, I mean, like, if that happens, if there is a physical afterlife of endless suffering, help me understand why you think it's God would be okay with that.
Yeah, honestly, it like I said, it is something that I really struggle with. And it's something that really has made me think about quitting, like, this whole Christian life before. But I keep pressing on. And honestly, mm-hmm. I feel like God strengthens my faith through it. But God is a good God, but that also means that he's a just God. It doesn't mean that he's our genie and he'll grant us whatever good thing that mm-hmm. we want, but he's just. So from what I understand in my limited human mind, God set up the universe, created the universe, Eden, Adam and Eve, to be a paradise. But he also gave us as human beings free will. And Adam and Eve ate from the tree that he told them not to. And that's considered the fall. So they betrayed God's commands. So that's the reason why we need Jesus, because God provided Jesus to basically pay that debt. Mm-hmm. But as a result, we live in a world full of sin. And so I've heard the analogy before that like we all deserve hell because of our human condition and defying God. And that God is actually gracious because he's providing, like saving a few of us from the burning hellfire. But that's really hard to grapple with, and really hard, like, why do certain people get saved from it and why do other people not get saved from it? So that is from what I understand in the Bible, but it's a hard thing to question and grapple with.
Jake, you said this is above your pay grade, but anything you want to add to that?
Oh, it is above my pay grade. I struggle with the idea that I struggle with the idea that arbitrary random people can be picked to be saved. That doesn't seem very just to me. It seems, you know, there's got to be some fairness in justness, not arbitrariness. But I don't. That God is not my area of expertise, so it's beyond me.
When you finally meet God, it's going to be this awesome interview. You're going to have so many questions, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Too many.
Very many. By the way, our colleague from City Newspaper, Becca Rafferty, says she's also Team Duran Duran and wants to know, why does Evan hate fun? Listen, take heart. I am wrong about political prognostications, all sporting prognostications, and most music. So if I dislike music you like, you can feel good about that. I'm just stating truth here. I also like to rib producer Megan Mack, who loves Duran Duran, and that is a band that I don't get. That one I don't. It's like one of those people who can see those kinds of art that came out in the 90s where some people can see the picture and some people can't, and I can't. Anyway, we got to get our only break of the hour. We're on WRUR this hour, and Rob wants to know if I like the band The Power Station. We're going to do a whole music hour. Forget philosophy. I've never heard of The Power Station. Okay, so I'm going to the bad place now, I've been told. Oh, it's half Duran Duran. I'm definitely going to the bad place. We're talking about The Good Place, the NBC show that just concluded a 4-year run on NBC, a show focused on a fictional afterlife in which Universe employees for many millennia have used a point system to determine who gets into essentially heaven or hell and whether it's fair and whether it should be redesigned and what the universe expects of human beings on Earth and how ethics are measured. And we're talking to Deanna Spiata, who is a nonprofit employee, a songwriter, and a worship leader at a local church, and a fan of the show. And Jake Vojtovich, who is also a fan of the show. He's an ethics and philosophy writer. He's a professor of ethics at Brockport. And after our only break of the hour, we're going to talk a little bit about the idea of the good place. We're going to get away from hell. Let's talk about heaven. The show had some interesting things to say about heaven that I did not see coming in the last couple of episodes. We got a clip, and that's on the other side of this break. Coming up in our second hour, we sit down with the superintendent of the Rochester City School District. That's Terry Dade. And we're talking about the cutting of 109 teachers just a month ago. An extraordinary move, cutting teachers in the middle of a school year. But the superintendent said it was necessary. That's how dire the fiscal emergency was. What happens to those teachers? There's a job fair coming up, and we'll talk about those efforts to place them elsewhere next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Glad to have you here. And I'll just remind you, if you're listening on WRUR, we're glad to have you here. We do have impeachment trial coverage over on WXXI, and a number of our listeners have expressed varying views of that. We feel it's important to continue to provide you that on WXXI, but Connections rolls on here. And as we talk about the philosophical underpinnings of a show like The Good Place, a 22-minute weekly show on NBC, kudos to the writing staff there. I mean, everybody's talking about the actors that we know, the Kristen Bells, the Ted Dansons, the let's see here. Who played? Was it William Jackson Harper who played Chidi? I mean, there was a great cast, but there was great writers as well. And in the scene we're going to listen to in just a moment here, it's a scene set in the good place or heaven. So the main characters of the show have just met, I love this, Hypatia of Alexandria. Now, Hypatia of Alexandria, and again, I'm not the expert here, but someone who was a real woman. She lived around 350 BC, and she was kind of often referred to as one of the first feminist icons because she was a mathematician, she was brilliant, but she was murdered in brutal fashion and became sort of, I don't know if martyr is the right word, but essentially she was kind of known as a martyr for philosophy, but a brilliant mathematical mind. So she's played in The Good Place in heaven. They find Hypatia of Alexandria, and she's played by Lisa Kudrow, who was Phoebe on Friends. And Chidi is very excited to meet this great philosophical mind, and it turns out Hypatia of Alexandria is sort of mush. And she calls herself Patty, and she spends most of her day drinking Stardust milkshakes, and she's explaining basically why her brain isn't sharp anymore. She's been there for thousands of years, and here she is explaining why heaven turns out to not be that great after all.
Wow, this milkshake is incredible.
Right? Mm. This is how I spend most of my time, sitting in beautiful places, drinking my milkshake, slowly peeing into my pants, which instantly evaporates and leaves no trace.
Sounds fun. Mm. But didn't you want to tell us how we're all screwed?
Ah, damn it. This this is the exact problem. On paper, this is paradise. All your desires and needs are met, but it's infinite. And when perfection goes on forever, you become this glassy-eyed mush person.
But no, because... No, because Patty, no!
Yes, I'm telling you. I used to be cool, man. I studied so much things. Art and music and the one with the number piles, where I'd be like 2 and you'd be like 6.
Math?
Yes. And then I came here, where time stretched out forever. And every second of my existence was amazing, but my brain became this big, dumb blob.
So we finally make it into the good place, and now we're just going to become zombies? Why haven't you told anyone about this?
That's Kristen Bell as Eleanor asking, why are we just finding out that heaven sort of sucks? That's Lisa Kudrow of Hypatia of Alexandria and William Jackson Harper as Chidi, who cannot get over the fact that one of his idols now doesn't even know what math is. So I love that scene. I love it for the comedy. Lisa Kudrow, she's essentially playing a Phoebe version of the same kind of character, but nails it. But I want to ask our guests in the studio about this idea. So, all right, Jake. So what she's really saying is try to think about eternity. Think about paradise. Think about what forever is. As human beings, everything is finite. Everything is sort of limited and linear. And she's saying what seems like it would be absolute paradise is great for a while and then not as great. And then it's pretty much blah. Does that ring true to you?
Partly. I think... So the philosopher Bernard Williams thought that death is really bad, but immortality is probably worse. Because he thinks you'll get really bored of everything.
Yeah, that's kind of the point they're saying.
And I think there's something to be said about that. But I also think what Williams doesn't take into account and what doesn't seem to happen to Patty in The Good Place is we'd have to change and adapt to immortality. And so I think it's really hard for us to understand what immortality would be like for people like us. And I think it would be really boring unless we adapted in some way. And also, they don't have any achievements in this afterlife because everything just happens for them. So I think we'd have to try and move away from that and sort of get used to this new life.
It doesn't sound as appealing when you think about it at length, but that is for a godless heathen like yourself, Jake. Here's the difference. I'm going to read an email from CJ who says, he said, first of all, I love that there's a show I can watch with my kids and discuss things I studied last century in college. And for what it's worth, hell to me is existing separate from God, cold with no fundamental purpose. Hopeless is hell enough. So what CJ's saying is, Deanna, the show is making an interesting point, but the show is not considering if God exists, being in the presence of God may change that equation. And that's what the emailer is saying. What do you think?
That's precisely what I was going to say. I think that as humans, and as Jake mentioned, it's hard for us to fathom living forever and not getting bored. But boredom is a characteristic of this world. And I believe that heaven will be a new world that God creates and we'll live with him. And the Bible suggests, and some people interpret this way, that we'll even have tasks that we do for God or activities that we do, but we'll never get bored or they won't be laborious.
No, great. Heaven sounds great. Just have God. I'm going to build a shed for God. God's going, no, I love you. But I could really use someone to mow the lawn.
But you won't dread it. I actually thought about that. I was like, is mowing the lawn going to be in heaven? But I think if it is I will enjoy it.
Omniscience just means making everyone... Omnipotence means just making everyone else do the work. That's actually quite brilliant.
Now, but do you see what I'm saying? Like
I do.
The work will be removed from the equation. It won't be something you dread.
It'll be
something that... Yes.
It is joyful. Yes. And so to me, that's two things. I think that is potentially a fair distinction... And it's also potentially a cop-out. So let's explore both of those in good faith here. I think you're right. The show doesn't explore that. And in the show's concept of an afterlife, in which God isn't a thing, and it's just whatever you want forever, whatever you want to eat, you want to go out with and have drinks with friends. You want to play sports. You want to read. Everything you could want. Beautiful sunsets. All the time, forever. I could see how I could do that for millennia, and then I could maybe change it up or maybe do something else. Do you at least see why, take God out of the equation, let's just sort of posit for the moment that there is no God, why that kind of a heaven would be eventually even kind of a drag?
Definitely, because I think that I actually thought the good place that's portrayed on the show, sometimes we get that like that on vacation, right? Like we're like, oh, I don't have to think about anything. This is so great. And then you're there for like maybe like 2 or 3 weeks is the longest. And then you're kind of like, this is boring.
Ready to get home.
Yeah. So, and I also think that it doesn't make a very good TV show to make heaven be satisfying forever. Like there's no challenge there. So
fair.
I think it doesn't make a good TV show.
All right. That's fair. And Eleanor, played by Kristen Bell, in the second to last episode, uses that exact analogy. She said, even vacations have to end. That's the only reason they're special, is that you know it will end. And so, by the way, I thought going into the last episode, they're going to kill everybody in heaven. That's what they're going to do. They don't exactly do that. They give you the option to end your existence in that way, and it sort of becomes sort of one with the universe, which is kind of like die, but or end your consciousness. Giving people the option in heaven ended up making people feel more fulfilled because they knew that eventually it would be over. And that was an interesting idea, not one that seems to jive with what you want, which is, you know, Christians are going for eternity with God. Christians are not like, eventually you can end my time. I'll turn the knob off here. You're not looking to shut it off.
Not an eternal life.
Yeah, yeah.
I think in this life we know that the hope of this life ending is that hopefully we'll have eternal life with God.
All right, I'm going to get to Linda and Penfield in a moment, but one more question for you, and then I want Jake's take on sort of the heaven idea. The cop-out to me is just that I think human beings can't really conceive of eternity very effectively because that's just not what we're programmed to do, and I think we're scared of death. And I think the idea, which by the way, I'm scared of death. I mean, like, it's totally natural. But the idea that we've convinced ourselves that we will just never have to deal with death is a comforting thing that seems entirely constructed to fit the purposes of assuaging our fears. Is that possible?
The fact that, can you say that again?
I think we're just created this idea of an eternal life because we
so
don't
that,
really don't want to deal with death.
Yep. I definitely think that I've heard people say that or argue that, that people who believe in a heaven just use it as a comforting factor. It definitely is comforting and it's hopeful. I don't think, for me, that's not why I believe. That's not why I believe in God. I believe in him because he loves me and I love him and I want to please him. But it definitely brings hope to the end of life. I still am afraid to die, though, a little bit. I don't think anybody wants to experience death.
I hate to do this, but do you think in the back of your mind, your fear of death comes with doubt that this endless life with God is actually going to be on the other side? Because if that were true, if you were 100% convinced, you'd be like, hey, when it comes, sign me
up. Well,
in.
I don't want to experience the pain of death,
I get to death.
It'll be
that.
Over, no, and then
that.
I'll be in heaven. It'll be great. But I don't want to experience the pain of death.
All right, I get you there. That's totally logical. Totally with you there. Jake, what do you think about the idea of heaven, you know, and this, some of the notion of God here maybe changing the equation?
I think it really does change the equation. But I'm not sure what that would be like and how much of us would remain in that sort of situation. You know, what if Evan would still be there in heaven with, you know, personality traits and things stripped away? Surely God doesn't want our, you know, narcissism or our bitterness or what, you know, all our bad traits would have to be stripped away. They couldn't be in heaven. So what would be left of us? Because, you know, our bad traits as well as our good traits make us who we are. Our sort of limited time on earth makes us who we are. So I just don't know what that would be like, and I don't know whether I would survive if that heaven existed or whether it would just be some soul or something, but I don't know how much that would be me. So.
That's a really interesting way of describing it. That's why Jake was invited. Let me get Linda in Penfield on the phone. Go ahead, Linda.
Hi, everyone. This is a very interesting topic. And so in the interest of time, I'm going to give you my then 7-year-old's idea of what heaven was like. Because she asked me, she would ask these questions, and she would say, Mom, what's heaven like? I said, oh, well, it's a place where you get to do what you want, and you get to see all your friends again, and you don't have to worry about working hard, and nothing is, you know, like giving you a headache or anything. It's just really, really great. And she says, that sounds a lot like being retired.
And you know what's interesting about that, Linda, is that I've talked to a couple of different people who've recently retired, and one of them describes retirement as a version of heaven on earth, and one describes it as hell. So my father's someone who wakes up and wants to feel like people need him to be there. And people like my mother would love to wake up and no one ever needs her again. So for some, it's heaven and some it's hell.
And this is me, right, is that it's your purpose. And borrowing the most recent sports thing, you know, people have been talking about Kobe Bryant, and, you know, there were some really great things about him and some maybe not so good things about him. But then after he retired from basketball, he found this whole new purpose. And this is me, right, is that we're here to do a purpose. And the purpose, I believe, is to be our true selves. And I think that's what, and of course, you can spend your whole life figuring out what true self is. You know, and I think that, so heaven, retired, it's about purpose. And some people, it's really hard to find that second purpose. Me, I'm going to be volunteering and just trying to do good things. So, So anyway, that was my 7-year-old version of what heaven was like.
Well, Linda, thank you. I really appreciate that phone call. And on the idea of... Look, it's in the news. Let's take Kobe. I mean, I'm going to try to address this as thoughtfully as I can. Someone like Kobe Bryant admitted in his life before his passing, and this was several years ago, that the woman who said that he raped her, that at the very least he now concedes that he understands that in the woman's mind it was not consensual sex. At a baseline, that's a big admission. In my conception of if there is a God that is sort of judging human beings, I grew in sort of my Christian days to think of God as like, is God so insecure that he'd rather have me on my knees telling him how great he is every Sunday? Or should I be helping people? Like, God would be like, I get it. I'm omniscient. I'm omnipotent. I'm good. You know, like, no more hymns, no more songs of praise. Get out there, do something good. And in the idea of Kobe Bryant, would the judgment be, have you truly made amends? If you've hurt someone, what have you done to atone for that beyond just taking me as a savior? Does that make sense, Deanna?
Yes, and honestly, Kobe Bryant has been it's been a hard week wrestling with those questions.
Sure.
So I don't really know how to comment. But I think that God sees our heart, and only God can know. God can be.
That is the definition of omniscience. You're right there. I mean, like, there's no way for us to see. If there is an omniscient creator, that omniscient creator's got access to information that we don't have. So I will ask you this. Who do you love most ethereally in this world? Who's the most important person to you?
Oh, gosh, my parents.
Okay. Let's say you get to heaven, and God says, Deanna, I love you. You get to spend eternity here. And you go, where's Mom? And God says, Mom didn't accept me. And you know that your mother is being tortured. Could you really feel like you're in paradise if you know what's going on to your mother?
If I knew that on this earth, it would be horrible and really hard to grapple with. If I'm in heaven, then there's no pain and suffering there. So,
but you don't think you'd suffer mentally thinking about your mom that way?
Not if I'm not a human being. I don't know. That's really, these are all like things I've just thought about in my head, and I don't know.
Yeah.
And sometimes I try not to ask myself those questions because they're so
hard. Because they're uncomfortable, right?
But yeah.
They're definitely uncomfortable. I hear you. Jake, and some final thoughts from you on that. The Good Place kind of wrestled with that too. You know, well, where's my friend in The Good Place? Where are my parents? I would find that really difficult personally. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I think that would be really hard because part of what makes life, you know, good is having friends and relationships and, you know, family and loved ones. And I think even if, you know, two or three important people, if you knew they were being tormented for forever, it would be unbearable. But that's part of what I was saying about, you know, are we still, how much are we still human?
Right. And I think that's Deanna's point. I mean, there's a lot we probably can't conceive of there. Yeah. And if there is a paradise and a deity, we are not really able in our ethereal form to just sort of figure out what that might be like, which again, I think is part absolutely on the money and part cop out. So that's, I think that's where I think it's really smart. And also like, I don't know. And that's why we wrestle with it. And I think the doubt's healthy. I thought for sure Megan Mack was going to kick with some Duran Duran music just to torture me. But I'll tell you what, that's how good her heart is. She's going to kick with Rah Rah Riot, which is absolutely the Good Place version of music. I want to thank you both for being here. I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed the show. And I think great stuff. Deanna Spiata, who's a worship leader at a local church, a songwriter, who says, by the way, if you look her up, that her website's a little out of date, but I'm still going to look it up. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Really enjoyed the conversation. Jake Wojtowicz, who's an ethics and philosophy writer. I wish I had professors like you at Brockport. They're lucky to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
All right. Short break. We're coming up with more connections on WRUR. The superintendent of Rochester City Schools, Terry Date, is here next.